I'd like to give a quotation to this effect from Richard Dawkins in his book, River Out of Eden, A Darwinian View of Life, pages 131 through 133, said this, quote, "But nature is neither kind nor unkind. She is neither against suffering nor for it. Nature is not interested one way or the other in suffering, unless it affects the survival of DNA. If the universe were just electrons or selfish genes, meaningless tragedies are exactly what we should expect, along with equally meaningless good fortune. Such a universe would be neither evil nor good in intention. It would manifest no intentions of any kind. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. As the unhappy poet A.E. Huffman put it," and this is still quoting from Dawkins, who is now quoting from Huffman, "for nature, heartless, witless nature, will neither know nor care. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music." That's the end of both quotations. Well, if evolution were true, and blind indifference, those kind of indifferent forces were at work, then Dawkins' characterization would be understandable. What is not understandable is the fact that we care about such things. Equally difficult to explain is the curious habit we have of placing value on things that, according to him, cannot be either good or bad. In other words, if nature is blind and indifferent and uninterested in what happens, then why should we, the product of these natural forces, feel any differently than our Creator? Why are we not like the one who created us in its own image? If a 2-year-old child drowns in the ocean, what is that to us? If nature is indifferent, and that is our God, then we must accept with indifference that these things happen. But we do not accept it with indifference. If students in a high school walk through the corridors randomly shooting their fellow students, we err greatly in assigning this a value of bad and getting emotionally upset about it. These killers are no different than nature when it spawns a tornado or a hurricane. An earthquake such as the one recently that occurred in Turkey devastates indiscriminately. It may occur in a sparsely populated area, or it may kill 18,000 people. The ground does not lament, "Oh, what have I done?" At Littleton, some students were shot and others were spared. Is one tragedy any different than any other? After all, those boys were just dancing to their DNA, according to Dawkins. The fact that human beings do have feelings, assign value of good or evil, or insist that certain actions ought not to happen, shows that we are not the offspring of nature. A true child of nature would need to be just as unfeeling about tragic events as nature itself is. When a volcano erupts and kills 2,000 villagers, we ought to be just as indifferent as we can possibly be, because this is nature and we ought to include matter-of-factly, yep, that's our God at work. If we just dance to our DNA, then we cannot help but be what we are. And there should not be any sense of personal responsibility. Homosexuals, adulterers, child molesters, murderers, drunkards, and otherwise generally nasty and obnoxious people are just being what they were born to be under this system. And we should be apathetic about it instead of trying to reform them or punish them. The possession of values attaching labels such as evil or good to events and expecting a person to change his behavior can only make sense if God exists and we derive those values and sense of goodness from Him. Compassion and feelings are not the child of emotional indifference, but of a personal being. Now that's one choice. The other choice is, in the beginning, God. If God does not exist, there's no basis for calling anything good or evil. However, the use of such labels naturally flows if there is one who has demonstrated that he does care what happens to the universe he created, and if he has also defined morality, that is, what constitutes good or evil. If we do not understand everything about why evil things occur, at least we have a basis for designating them good or evil. But the question remains, how do we account for the origin of evil? If God is good, how did evil get here? On the surface, the answer would seem to be that God created it. Yet it would be unthinkable to conclude that God, who is defined as loving, would create sin and suffering. Therefore, we have to look to the Bible to provide answers for the explanation of evil. Has evil always existed? Potentially, it has. In reality, it has not. Before God created anything, spiritual or physical, there was complete and thorough goodness. There was no evil. Had God chosen for things to remain that way, that is, for Himself and only Himself to exist throughout eternity, then sin would have been denied any expression or existence. Even with the idea of creation, sin could have been avoided. Humans could have been created to obey God without thought or without question. But in such a construct, meaningful thought would be absent, for what is there to think about when there are no decisions to make? There can likewise be no willingness to obey, since one must do what one is bid in that kind of situation. Neither would there be any kind of genuine feeling of love or warmth. Programmed affection is meaningless. If you could program your computer to every time you turn it on say, "I love you," would you take great pleasure in that? It would only be doing what you'd programmed it to do. There would not be any kind of sense of real affection. But as soon as the idea of creating beings with free will is presented, everything changes. Now if a command of any type is given, in addition to the previous answer of yes, its opposite, no, can also be exercised. No is the option of disobedience, transgression, or sin. Did therefore God create sin? No, but He created the opportunity for it when He gave His creatures free will. When God created spirit beings, the voice of rebellion was heard through the one that we now know as Satan. It was he who first saw the opportunity of saying no to God and then followed through with it by daring to disobey Him. In a sense, evil had its origin with Satan, when he realized that he had the power of choice and took advantage of that power of choice to sin and rebel against his Creator. To him, God's love and goodness were insufficient reasons to follow Him. Instead, he selfishly challenged God's leadership and was the first to say, "I'm going to do what I want to do, even if it kills me." Free will, then, explains the origin of evil. But having discussed that briefly, we want to next look at the argument from evil that atheists often make. This began, at least we have the first recorded instance of it, with Epicurus about the 4th century B.C. But we want to look at the argument put forth by Mackey in a couple of different sources. He offers these 6 points. Number one, God is omnipotent. Number two, God is perfect in goodness. Number three, evil exists. Number four, a good thing always eliminates evil as far as it can. Number five, there are no limits to what an omnipotent being can do. And number six, a good omnipotent thing eliminates evil entirely. Now we'd like to talk about these points for a few moments. That's the argument, basically, that is made. Sometimes it has a little bit different point. Maybe something is worded a little bit differently. Some step is omitted. But that's the basic argument to try and disprove the existence of God. Mackey then, after making this 6 points, says that the existence of God violates these six propositions. Therefore, if they are correct, God does not exist, which is true, if they were correct. But they are not all correct. In fact, we agree with the first three propositions. God is omnipotent, He is perfect in goodness, and evil exists. We agree with those, but they can be true. Numbers 2 and 3 can only be true if God exists. Without a divine revelation which delineates what is good and what is evil, we cannot know what good and evil are. If the conclusion of Mackey's proposition is that God does not exist, then that destroys really all of them except number one, that God is omnipotent. Because if you look at number two, God is perfect in goodness, but how are you going to define goodness apart from God? And evil exists, but how are you going to define evil without an objective standard to say what evil is? So propositions 2 through 6 contain value judgments which cannot exist or are totally arbitrary if we are the independent product of nature. Now someone might argue, well, okay, we cannot agree on value on certain things. We can't agree that adultery is always wrong. We cannot agree that abortion is wrong, or homosexuality, or lying, or any other kinds of evil. We have people on both sides of those issues and those moral judgments. But we would respond, well, how are we going to define this proposition if we don't know what these things are? Even with the Bible, people take both sides of those moral issues. So maybe they would say, well, we can all agree on one thing. Let's suppose that a stray planet broke loose of some orbit and ended up in our galaxy and collided with Earth and destroyed all human life. We can all agree that that would be evil. No, we can't. Because if we all got here by accident, what's the problem with being removed by accident? What is evil about random accidents in a thoughtless universe? You see, we don't really have any basis to agree upon anything if we accept these propositions. Proposition number 4 is an assumption which cannot be proven or demonstrated. God is good, yet He allows evil to exist. That's what proposition number 4 says, and in fact, God knew that evil would come into existence with the creation of free will. So if a good thing eliminates evil as far as it can, then it would be logical to further conclude that a good thing would not permit evil to exist in the first place. Since evil is not eternal, and God created the possibility for evil's existence, why start with God getting rid of evil instead of His creating the possibility for evil? Let's look at proposition number 5 for a few moments. This relates to the same issue. An omnipotent being cannot create beings with a free will without creating the possibility of evil. Mackey wants to define omnipotence as meaning that God can do anything. But all that the word means is that God possesses all power and all authority, as we read in Matthew 28:18. In fact, there are some things that the Scriptures teach that God cannot do. God cannot lie. Titus chapter 1 and verse 2 and Hebrews chapter 6 verses 17 and 18. In a broader sense, God cannot be other than what God is. He cannot change His character and say, today I will not be good. I will tell lies today. I will crush the innocent, and I will set the guilty free. We ought to be grateful that God changes not, James chapter 1 and verse 17, or we would be wondering daily, is this the day that we're supposed to commit adultery or that we get punished for committing adultery? God cannot act contrary to His nature. He doesn't change His moral values on things all of the time. They are constant. They are stable. Neither can God choose to be illogical. He cannot say, today, A, which is defined by certain elements, such as all even numbers, will equal non-A, the set of all odd numbers. He can't do that. He cannot be illogical. Or he cannot tomorrow say, you know, I think the Pythagorean theorem won't work. Oh, when we add the square of 3, which is 9, the square of 4, which is 16, and we get 25, and that is the square of the hypotenuse, 5, you know, today it works, but tomorrow it's not going to work. God doesn't do that. Though He sometimes possesses powerful emotions, He remains logical. And His emotions do not cloud His judgment. He is always able to say, come and let us reason together. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 18. Some have requested that God perform something that violates accepted definitions. As Brother Warren puts it, God cannot make a four-sided triangle because, by definition, a triangle has three sides. And then Warren comments appropriately, rather than saying that God cannot do the things just referred to, it would be more in harmony with the truth to say simply that such things cannot be done at all. God is infinite in power, but power meaningfully relates to what can be done and what is possible of accomplishment, not to what is impossible. The objector, by saying, here's something that God cannot do, therefore He is deficient or limited in power and is not omnipotent, is implying that the making of a four-sided triangle is something that God could do if He only had more power. But it's not a matter of power. It's a matter of definition. Thus we see that possessing all power and authority does not enable one to do the impossible. It is impossible for God to be Himself and not be Himself at the same time. He cannot possess all of His wonderful attributes yet maintain their exact opposites simultaneously. He cannot authorize a definition and then violate and distort that definition into something that makes it meaningless. Apparently, these principles are hard for some to grasp. But if we just reason with them, we can come through to correct decisions. Brother Warren makes the connection between free will, evil, and correct definition in this quotation. In summary, it is not a denial of omnipotence of God to say that He cannot create a free moral agent who is guaranteed against ever committing even a single sin. It would be more accurate to say that the creation of such a being is impossible. No power, not even an infinite power, can create a being who is a free moral agent and yet who is beyond the possibility of sinning. There is an absurdity involved in asking, why did you not make men who do not have the properties of men? And that's what we would be saying when we ask and question free will. It's not that God lacks power. It's just that you cannot have free will without the possibility of sinning. And so that's where it comes from, and that's why it's there. Mackey's fifth proposition is invalid then. There are limits to what an omnipotent being can do. When somebody demands of him the impossible, the illogical, or to define something in a way that alters its properties without altering the definition as well. It is not necessary to argue against Mackey's sixth proposition because God will do that. At least in terms of heaven, evil and those who have chosen it will continue to exist, but they will be totally separated from God and all of His goodness. So it's only a question of when God does this, not if He's going to do this. The argument from evil then fails in the following ways. The existence of evil does not conflict with the goodness of God, number one. Number two, God's opposition to evil will result in its eradication at the appropriate time, 2 Peter 3:8-9. And number three, without God's existence, we cannot discern between good and evil. In a random universe, acts of men like acts of nature cannot be classified as either good or evil. Now, that's a kind of a philosophical approach to this. We want to next deal with the question, why do bad things happen to good people? Now, in a sense, we've answered that. But when somebody is suffering or in a great deal of pain, they probably don't want to hear a philosophical argument. We might agree with everything that's been presented and understand why evil exists, but that's not a lot of comfort when somebody is suffering. We also know that pain and suffering came into the world because of sin, Genesis chapter 3. And so its introduction came through a man who was tempted by Satan. Let's take a look at some statements of those who have undergone some suffering. In the book, I use several denominational people who have written on this subject, not because we agree with them in terms of salvation or the church or correct worship, but because of the observations they have made on this subject, which seem to be valid. In her book, Silent September, Joyce Landorf writes several passages about the pain she has experienced as a result of her TMJ. Pain has scraped away the last visible traces of hope off the edges of my soul. Naively, I always think that pain can do nothing more to me, yet I am always wrong. The scissors of pain have cut all the cords of joy, humor, faith, and hope, and I am left dangling above a deep black hole of despair. Now, she's probably a little more poetic than some would be, but you get the idea of the intense suffering that some people have to go through. Maybe you have never suffered to this extent. I haven't. And many people do not. And so it might be difficult to try and understand people who could make statements like this, but it shows the intensity of the pain when they speak in this way. Other types of suffering also exist. Besides the ravages of disease, there survive a number who have had a loved one's life taken as a result of man's inhumanity to man. We just had the shootings in Fort Worth a few weeks ago. And while we in America think maybe things should be better because we hear of murders that are never solved, nevertheless, how does that compare with other nations that are experiencing ethnic cleansing at the hands of some dictator who remains in power? So we do have problems, but not nearly the problems that some experience. Mankind usually laments what we call, quote, natural catastrophes, such as earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods. In fact, we just had, I guess, an estimate about 600 people, perhaps, in Mexico have died as a result of flooding. Volcanoes and other phenomena of less devastating abilities. Since the world was perfect, when God completed it, these things did not befall mankind until later. And I think perhaps some of these or all of these things have come into his existence as a result of the flood, which was the result of excessive sin on the part of man. You recall Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5, and God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imaginations of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Well, the penalty from that for that was very encompassing. In Genesis 7:11, we read, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day, were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. It's described briefly, but think about the cataclysmic event that is occurring with all of the fountains of the deep being broken up. The topography of the earth was changed forever as a result of that. And so if we want to blame natural disasters on somebody, we really have to only look towards ourselves and sin rather than thinking that God did these things when He created the earth. Of course He did not. There are other things, accidents, suicides, even death by natural causes prompts grief and heartache for us. Now what we want to notice is that the result that many people have, that many people experience, first of all is anger. We need to understand that people do experience anger. It's a natural response. One person wrote, "I'm so mad at God, I don't know why I ever believed in Him. He is so cruel to us. He just plays with our lives." C.S. Lewis wrote upon the death of his wife from cancer, "But go to Him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face and the sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become." Now, that was written by one who generally had a respect for God and has written a number of very good books. But it shows the intense suffering and anger that people have when these things happen. We may be shocked by things like this, but they are typical, and sometimes they are not expressed because people know they shouldn't say those things. But nevertheless, they may be thinking those things. Consider what Job said in Job 7, verses 11 through 16. "Therefore I will not refrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I a sea or a whale that thou settest a watch over me? When I say my bed shall comfort me, my couch shall ease my complaint, then thou scarest me with dreams and terrifiest me through visions, so that my soul chooseth strangling and death rather than my life. I love it. Let me alone, for my days are vanity." Job's response is not untypical to the way many people feel in the face of extreme anguish and grief and suffering. We read also, and I'm going to use the New Revised Standard Version here, not that I recommend it in its entirety, of course, but it happens to word it very well. From Job 21, 23, and 25, "One dies in full prosperity, being wholly at ease and secure. Another dies in bitterness of soul, never having tasted good." Certainly, God was patient with Job, and so do we need to be over those who are angry over the existence of evil in the world when it suddenly becomes personal to them. One writer and sufferer pleads for understanding with those who express their anger. "How dearly we need to have someone be patient with our doubts, to let us vent our anger and to understand our frustrations. We need someone not to condemn, challenge, or lecture, but to lovingly help us to wait it out. Someone to turn our eyes upon Jesus." Well, I didn't expect you for a while. After anger, there is a lot of times despair, and Psalm 88 and verse 18 expresses this quite well in the NIV, which again I don't recommend, but they did a good job on this one verse. "You have taken my companions and loved ones from me. Darkness is my closest friend." That's how many people are when these things happen. People ask, "Why? Why me? Why have I been deserted? Why has this happened?" One person pointed out that nobody ever asks, "Why not me?" And Dr. M. Scott Peck said, "It's a strange thing. Dozens of times I've been asked by patients or acquaintances, 'Dr. Peck, why is there evil in the world?' Yet no one has ever asked me in all these years, 'Why is there good in the world?'" How ironic that we just expect good, and when evil comes, we get upset because the universe that we have been enjoying is no longer the same to us. But though people may feel despair, and even though C.S. Lewis mentioned that silence, heaven is not silent. It may seem like it at that time, but heaven has spoken. We do have explanations. It's just that we feel deserted and abandoned, but God is always with us. Now, in the next 40 minutes, I want to discuss how can we comfort those who are suffering. A few things not to say. Number one, don't tell people there's some sin in your life that you need to repent of. If somebody is suffering a great deal, I guarantee you they've already thought of that. And they probably examined every vestige of their life and made promises that they intend to keep if they can just get through this thing. Don't tell people, number two, well, you just need more faith. They're already feeling bad enough. They don't need the burden to be increased. Number three, don't tell people, well, you know, it's God's will. One can just imagine a weary patient responding to this attempt at comfort by saying, oh, thanks, I feel so much better now. Would you like to trade places? This line of thinking is undoubtedly born of Calvinism. Kushner, who wrote Why Did Bad Things Happen to Good People, offered this evaluation. I cannot make sense of the Holocaust by taking it to be God's will. Even if I could accept the death of an innocent individual now and then without having to rethink all my beliefs, the Holocaust represents too many deaths, too much evidence against the view that God is in charge and He has His reasons. I have to believe that the Holocaust was at least as much an offense to God's moral order as it is to mine, or how can I respect God as being a source of moral guidance? No, God allows these things to happen, but He's not in favor of them. And when we suffer, He suffers with us. Don't give people easy answers. Easy answers deny the recognition and the sympathy and suffering and suffering and integrity demand. Suggestions for comforting people. Number one, the best thing to do at the beginning when somebody is angry or when they feel deserted is maybe just not to say anything. Just knowing that you're there and that you care may well be sufficient. If you say something, try to make it nondescript, such as saying, well, I know that you're suffering, and I'm sorry. That's more than Job ever got from his three friends. Admit to the fact that life is unfair. But don't confuse life being unfair with God being unfair. One person was interviewed. His wife had cancer. He was in a car wreck. The whole family was. As a result of that, he was not able to function normally, couldn't even climb stairs without assistance. And the interviewer thought, surely he's going to be very disappointed with God. And the man said this, the reason I'm not disappointed with God is that I learned first through my wife's illness and then especially through the accident not to confuse God with life. I'm no stoic. I'm about as upset at what happened to me as anyone could be. And I feel free to curse the unfairness of life and to vent all of my grief and anger. But I believe God feels the same way about the accident that I do. Grieved and angry. I don't blame Him for what happened. Realize that God is with us. Number four, through the hardships of life, realize that it is Satan who is the cause of the evil things that happen in the world. If you want to get mad at somebody, get mad at Satan. And there are many other points that could be made along these lines, and in fact, they are made in the book. One person wrote, you do not have to sit outside in the dark. However, if you want to look at the stars, you will find that darkness is required. I don't know of anybody who wants to suffer. But after we have gotten through anger and after we have gotten through despair, then it's time to realize that there are more important things than just us in the universe, and that maybe God does have something in mind. Certainly, God cares about us. One person says that God suffers with us now that we may laugh with Him later. The poet Ralph Waldo Emerson surmised correctly, all that I have seen teaches me to trust the Creator for all that I have not seen. We need to realize that in a time of suffering, that God is not aloof, He is not silent, He has already spoken, He has already explained it to us. And as we read in Romans 8:28 through 39, there is nothing that can separate us from the love of God.